I'm Kirsten Winters. I don't think anybody is here. I want to just preface this by saying I am not an economist, but I'm going to be talking a little bit about a viewpoint that was created by economists, and I hope it affirms what you feel that you're doing if you work in the church, or if you think about relationships and trust. I hope that it affirms what you're doing. So the title of this is The Commons. We're going to talk about the tragedy of the commons, so beyond tragedy. So kind of the central questions that I'm working with today have to do with, how do we ensure there's enough for all, including future generations, in a world where resources are limited? And also, how do we find common ground with others who may have different values or who we might be in competition with? I first came across a woman, Eleanor Ostrom, who I'm going to be talking about. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. She's an economist out of the University of Indiana, Bloomington. And I first came across her when I was working on a project with a bunch of people looking at national water policy in five countries in the Middle East and North Africa. And we were interested in how kind of top-down approach the institutions of the country were governing water, and then also how smaller groups or stakeholders or smaller central groups and local communities were dealing with water. So I first came into contact with this topic a few years ago, and I've been interested in it ever since. So we are going to talk a little bit about the economist's viewpoint, and like I said, I'm not an expert in this topic, but I think these terms or this viewpoint is really interesting and will be interesting to talk about tonight. So just a few assumptions or rules that we're going to set. First of all, the economist thinks about the individual with a set of choices and thinking that humans make rational choices. They always want to maximize goodness for themselves. The market is kind of where everything functions. Information is known. There are rules and sets of actions that people take. There's an action arena or a place where action happens, and then there are benefits and costs. We're not going to spend much time on this, but Eleanor Ostrom, who I'll be talking about tonight, started school in the 1950s when things were real simple, and she's made a lot of changes. So has anybody heard of Tragedy of the Commons before? Okay, excellent. So you know all about Hardin, and I just want to talk about this idea of public goods versus private goods. And this is kind of essential because we're going to be moving on to this idea of trust in a little bit, but I want people to know about public goods versus private goods. So this is originally from the economist's viewpoint, public good, something that is not rivalrous and not excludable, meaning your use of it doesn't take away from other people, and you can't exclude anybody else from using it. So peace, for example, or if there's a free fireworks show, your viewing of that fireworks show, you know, and you're not in competition for it, and it doesn't exclude anybody. Private goods, rivalrous and excludable. So you consume something and there's a cost, and your use of it takes it away from other people. And basically, this is important, Hardin came up with this idea of Tragedy of the Commons, and he was saying, basically, and he used this metaphor of a pasture, and he said, if there's just this open pasture that everybody can use and just let their cows graze on this, pretty much everybody is sharing in the cost, or, you know, this is free for everybody to use. This is a public good in this case. But what happens if one of those farmers decides that he's somehow going to add more cows, okay, to it, and so all of a sudden starts to take away the resource from other people? Do you guys understand this in the same way? So that the cost is being taken on by the other people in the system. And so he's benefiting, and he's going to maximize benefits for himself at the cost of others. And basically, the economists say that everybody's caught in a social dilemma. Do I take away from others to serve myself? are my choices going to help other people, or how is this all going to work out in the end? Does anybody else have anything else to add to that?
When you have something in common, there has to be rules and regulations.
And we're going to get to that. Yeah. Okay. And Hardin says, if everybody is just interested in maximizing their own profit, and we're sharing this really sad-looking pasture, and nobody's really looking out for the public good, what's going to happen is that we're going to use that pasture up, or that resource up, to the point where we're passing a threshold, it's going to be destroyed, and that's a tragedy. And he talked a lot about population, and he kind of has some interesting ideas all about what the heck do we do so we don't use up this public resource and we don't ruin it for future generations.
I think what he was saying too is that if one person does, adds more cows, it's probably not going to matter much.
But if everybody
starts
to do it.
And another one that's destroyed.
Right, and we have competition, and it's just this madhouse. And he says that the only way to get around this is for external authority to create rules, to analyze the situation, and to regulate. And he says that this is the most, you know, this is the only way to get around this.
Chris, yes. One more thing I'd add to that is he also critiques the utilitarian principle, the greatest good for the greatest number, saying that really when you think about it in terms of the commons, you can either do one or the other, but you can't do both, that they end up being a logical contradiction.
Does that make sense? Yeah, that's excellent. Thank you for adding that. Yeah. So and that's the dilemma. That's right. A social dilemma. That's a choice. And the great thing about this economist, Eleanor Ostrom, is that there has been some developments. It's more complicated than that. And so her early work was, again, in water in California, and she's done all these very mathy game theory equations with empirical research with people and groups and how do they manage their resources. And since Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, she kind of challenges it and says things have changed. We have this other category called a common pool resource. And it's hard to exclude people from use of things like water or, say, fisheries when you go fishing in the wild and then you sell your fish. It's hard to exclude your competitors. But when you use a resource like water or a product, like you're catching fish and you're selling it, your use of that takes it away from somebody else. So how do we manage that? How do we manage that resource? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. She asks this question, what do we do about this? And you can think of some other examples of common pool resources. And this is kind of the difficulty that we have. If you think about, say, you can take this to another level and you think about, say, a public park. And you go to the park and you see somebody littering. Okay, and this is somebody's using the park, and the way that they're using it is subtracting from other people's experience of it. And it can get really heady and philosophical, but it's more complicated than just public and private goods, and that's an important thing to think about. So under Hardin's kind of theory, we think about regulation. And here's an example of regulation that probably was necessary. The Endangered Species Act. Are people familiar? You're familiar with this. The rules, a federal law about protecting species so that they come back from extinction. Federal agencies are to ensure that the actions to authorize, fund, or carry out are not likely to jeopardize listed species. And the law prohibits any action that causes a taking of a listed species. So if you want to go fishing, you have to get some sort of permit from to be able to fish at a certain time, for example, to protect a species. And there are lots of examples of court cases. I think we have a lawyer in the room who maybe could tell us more about it. But so this is an example of outside authority regulating a resource. But does every common pool resource need to be regulated by an outside authority? It's expensive to regulate. It's hard to enforce. It's not always the most effective. And it overlooks the fact of changing contexts. Formally regulated and enforced laws are slow to be created and changed. Eleanor Ostrom also kind of makes this point herself. And so we move from this idea of needing outside authority to what? To something else. She discovered in some of the work that she's done that yes, people compete to maximize individual benefits, but people also cooperate, communicate, and develop agreements. Yes, resources need to be governed, but in local self-organized systems, people are able to govern effectively. And so if you think about the original questions that I was asking, how are we going to maintain for the future our resources? What are we, how do we deal with disagreements between groups that don't have the same values? Where do we go from there? And she found that it's actually interaction over time. She added this quality of time, that you actually need to have some permanency and connection with people over time. It increases ability to understand others and to come up with best response strategies to optimize outcomes for all. And it increases the likelihood that people create and adopt effective practices and chances for interaction. And this is was part of her Nobel Prize speech that she did. All right, and she even has a model of trust. This is the only model I'm going to show you tonight. But I think it's really, it's kind of blurry. It's kind of interesting to see that an economist came up with this model for trust. It's something that, I don't know about you, but I feel like in the church community, we do so easily without analyzing it. We don't even think about what is trust. We think about it, but we don't analyze it using a table. But she's done this here, talking about, I don't know if you can read it. It's not very clear here. But she goes through this kind of this model of there are norms in individuals, levels of trust that other participants are reciprocators, levels of cooperation and net benefits. And so she says she boils it down to net benefits for everybody, trust. And that feels a little bit weird as a faith community to think about trust and in an economic way, but here she's done it, and here she's saying we need social trust. And that was how she ended her Nobel Prize speech, with this idea of we need social trust and we need to develop this. And so she also talks about collective action and this also being a part of the model of what we need to do to govern our natural resources. I wanted to show the actual speech that she did, but I only have it on the internet and it won't work here, so I'm not able to do that. So basically, Eleanor Ostrom has done this research using empirical evidence, and she's done research on different communities. And she says, extensive empirical research leads me to argue that instead of institutions forcing individuals to achieve better outcomes, a core goal of public policy should be to facilitate the development of institutions that bring out the best in humans. We speak about the church as an institution, and we think about institutions as formal and informal, and as ways to guide relationships. There are rules and norms and symbols. That's how she defines institutions. And so what I was hoping to have from you is a discussion about what do you think about this economist's model? How do you think it bumps up against your thoughts and feelings about trust as a faith community? And what do you think about the length that we should go to as far as exerting outside authority on the management of common pool resources?
I'm Jeff. I guess what I would pipe in with that last slide, the sentence at the bottom really caught my attention when it talked about, or not that one, keep that one right there. Go forward one. That.
Okay.
Figure five, where it says micro situational and broader context of social dilemmas affects the levels of trust and cooperation. And I think about it and I look at our society today. And, you know, it appears to me that our social norms and cultures are degrading, that we're getting smarter, but we're in a decline in how we treat each other and stuff. And I look at these definitions and things when you talk about trust, and I think that speaks directly to that topic in that, you know, you know, you talked about, you know, when Ahlstrom was first going to school, things were a lot easier. And, you know, since then, people have had a lot of situations that they have been in that have now created these biases to where it's like, well, hey, I need to get what I can get. You know, I'm in this for me. Forget everybody else. So it makes it a lot harder, you know, to think of the common trust. When if truly if society is going downhill and thinking only about themselves.
So you're pessimistic about
yeah
where we're headed as yes. far as the society goes. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, sorry, this will be a short anecdote, but I'm wondering where the start point of that spiral is, because I just, this past year, had a really interesting experience, which is I've worked in PTA organizing for 13 years, because I have a senior who just graduated. And I took on a PTA position this year at his high school as the liaison for the Outdoor Education Club. And I have never, in all my 13 years, worked with an administration at a school that I didn't trust. I've worked with administrations that I didn't agree with, but never one that I didn't trust. And this was an administration, they administrate through the back door, instead of through the front door. And I'm totally a front door person, and I didn't trust them. And until seeing this, I didn't realize my reaction to that was actually not to become untrustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, I didn't go and try and find a back door way to do it myself, right? I went straight to the district, because I worked in PTA for a long time, and I knew how to do this right.
Right.
But I totally limited my scope. So whereas before, I would have been like, not quite the tattletale,
right.
but I would have been trying to bring to light some of what was going on
sure.
and to kind of
sure.
inform the PTA's interaction with the administration and to make things right. And all I wanted was my program to find the $8,000 that had gotten lost and put it back in the postbank.
So is this something where you had a relationship with a long, a history with these people, or this
I have a history with the district, and it's a good history as a PTA organizer. I mean, I've done a lot with it; it's been great. Do I have a long history with this administration? Well, my son had been there; this was his fourth year, so I knew the administration, and I knew some things. I didn't realize until this year how untrustworthy they were.
Mm-hmm.
So they had done some things that maybe. But what I'd be curious about hearing from people. Is in that particular situation, I was like, oh yeah, sure. I went back to a shortened version of the public good. I went back to something more like a private good because
so you switch.
I don't trust them. I can't deal with them. I can't cure this. I'm going to take care of my piece,
yeah.
which is this outdoor education money. So, but I would be curious to hear in organizations that aren't untrustworthy. Because there's part of me that's like, that's uncurable. But how is it that you, what are the physical, immediate, real signs of trust? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I'm not sure I can answer that as far as, or did you want to
add? Just a comment on that I think you meant American society when you said, you know, we're degrading,
yes.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I am quite familiar with the research on what happens to healthcare when there's economic inequality.
Uh-huh.
And regardless of, you know, whether it's England and a national healthcare service or a zip code in the United States, if there's great income disparity, uh-huh. the health of that population is worse.
Mm. Interesting, yeah.
And I have a hunch that income disparity, which has grown in the U.S. over the last 30 years quite substantially, is a factor in creating lack of trust and the inability to do some of the kinds of cooperative work. I would at least I would put that out as a hypothesis.
So you're saying that that's a limit of the resource, which would be healthcare, increases competition and this feeling of not being able to. Think about the greater good.
But it also sounds like you're saying that equality is one of those
equality is
symbols
one
of trust.
Is one of the symbols
incoming
of trust.
Things that we look at and say trust from
interesting. Yes. I just sort of wanted to redirect a question really quick. Could you go like a couple slides? One more? Nope, one more, sorry. Oh, okay, never mind. Well, I can't find it. But where she says a core, or I can't remember if it's he, a core goal of public policy should be to develop that one.
Mm-hmm.
So are you suggesting that the church is something that this person intended when they wrote this statement? Or what might be other ones of these institutions? Because I can really imagine institutions forcing individuals to achieve better outcomes. That's something that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
But what would that look like to facilitate the development of institutions like that?
Yeah, and she, I don't think she directly states what she means by that because she, you know, she's not advocating, but she does in one of her political theories talks about how institutions, again, are formal or informal, so the church would be a formal institution, and, you know, there's doctrine, and there's, is it Leviticus that has all the rules for the, is that right, all the, in the Old Testament, Leviticus? What is it?
The holiness code.
And so, obviously, in the history, you know, there's kind of this idea of in law and gospel we think about in the New Testament. I'm not a theologian, so I don't know how far to take that. But definitely, even in the Lutheran Church, I was just thinking about Luther and this idea of disturbance and how he was a disturbance on the Catholic Church and broke away and made this whole new regime of a resilient church that's lasted, you know. So I do believe that the church is one place, and I know when I think about it, that is part of this. I was talking to a pastor last night, Mary, and she was saying, you know, that's, we meet every week face to face, and we talk about values, and that's exactly where we should be dealing with these issues is in the church. But there are also informal institutions, and those are things that just codes of conduct as far as how you treat people. And those break down if you're not in the same place for a long time and you don't have a history of people. I live in a graduate school town or college town where people are coming and going all the time. And I think to myself, 2 years from now, we start over because same people aren't here anymore. And so that might change the way people treat each other and resources. Yeah.
The assumption is that within humanity, there is, quote, the best that can be brought to the common good. What in my thinking about what you're saying in your comment about the school administration, if the administrative, the higher echelons show distrust for the public shows distrust to the administrative authorities.
So it's reciprocal, or
there is something about that that's a dynamic balance. I mean, we do elect officials, and but it's not like an oligarch. It's not the king who says this is the rule. There's this in a democracy. In a democracy, there's this balance that makes it somewhat frightening to think that it's hard for one end to trust the other end.
Do
you know what this extensive empirical research was?
Yeah, she's done, her work is very complicated because she uses this game theory, which is a whole bunch of, there are a whole bunch of numbers and lines and things she adds, people making choices basically. She's done work in Nepal, she's done work with fisheries, and she has done a lot of work with water in California, that's where she started, and with all sorts of different, she's mainly in the natural resource field, and she's really looking at smaller groups of stakeholders managing a resource and whether they're competing or cooperating and maintaining that resource and how well they're doing. So she evaluates them, and I don't do the math, the game theory. I think it's really complicated to put a number on choice. But yeah, so she works in small natural resource management type.
Well, I think, for example, that's one of the examples I know about. You know, they try to regulate how many fish are caught in different species and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real conflict between the sports fishermen who do it for fun and the between the commercial fishermen, that's their livelihood.
Yeah.
And the commercial fishermen just as soon have the sports fishermen not catch any fish, and vice versa. You know, that,
they have a different interest in it.
Yeah, so yeah. How do you resolve something like that with some of your ideas?
That's a good question. Sometimes I believe outside regulation is necessary, like in the case of endangered species, I believe that outside, that those laws are necessary to bring back, say, salmon. That's a good question. I'm not sure I can answer that. Does anybody have yet?
I can't answer that. I just have another question.
Oh, okay.
You want to continue?
Yeah,
that?
No. Well, yeah, go ahead.
There's some places where. I don't know about that particular instance, but where if you bring all the stakeholders together and they, and you figure out what the sports fisherman needs really are and what the commercial fisherman, sometimes you can find a way to satisfy both of those, or at least some part of both of those. But it's, it requires long discussions and putting the stakeholders together face-to-face.
Sometimes like a conflict resolution type situation.
I think they did some of that with the Columbia River.
Yeah.
And they brought, agriculture and fisheries and environmentalists who want to protect the salmon. And they put in some religious people and tried to bring a broad group of stakeholders together and see if they could hammer out something that met at least most of everybody's needs.
Yeah.
But if I could just jump in on that, because I've been looking at this stop, and that's a good example of the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. Argue that instead of institutions forcing individuals to achieve a better outcome, it also can hamstring when you overregulate. A real quick example, we had about a 40-acre fire down near Cascade Locks. 3 days after the fire, the incident commander wanted to basically do what we call sports falling of these trees right on the utility line, because those trees were going to come down over the next few years, one by one, causing all the utilities to have to come out there and restring their lines and stuff. And they're like, we got the resources out here, let's just plan this. They'll drop the lines, we'll get a bunch of fallers out there, we'll drop the trees, we'll be done with it in a couple of hours. Efficient, fast, serving the customer. Resource person says, nope, you cannot do that without a NEMA statement, because you have to study what it will do to the frogs.
Yeah, yeah. The
NEPA,
right.
Their ecosystem right now is black, you know. So, you can over-regulate and create institutions that are forcing your hand, and then you're hamstrung.
Yeah.
And then you lose trust.
Yeah.
But I think that's what the important thing about Osterman says is that what it takes is time. And in these situations, people are in crisis mode. We got to do it now. We got to make a decision now. And it takes a long discussion to...
But, that time, that's what the relationship is building. Like, everybody in here knows, if you spend one day with somebody and talk to them, the next time you talk to that person, you're going to have so much more, not only admiration, but you're much more likely going to accept what they have to say. But also, in all of this, basically what seems like is being said is bottom-up regulation is what works. People have to decide for themselves that this is what is going to be good, because not only is it then deciding, it's when people are heard, they feel trusted. When people express themselves, they feel like they're part of the decision-making process. And with that, they have more, to me, responsibility of going through with that.
Yeah, they own it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And
that's what with your TTA thing is like, if all those people could talk and have a serious open discussion, like, hey, this is what needs to be done, then there's more likely going to be cohesion, and
And with that, we just got off the boat today, and we have a staff meeting.
Oh yeah, I know. Whoever has to go to the staff meeting, and I know a lot of people have to go, so that's why people are leaving, so we can. I actually just was going to say too, what I was hoping to get from you guys for just my own
knowledge on your opinion, is how does this bump up against maybe your experience, knowledge, and encounters with the idea of trust or the concept, or I don't want to call it a concept, but the trust in the church? And do you see the church having a role in what we're talking about here? And if so, what is it, or how do you see
yourself? Certain certain fields the church knows a lot about, but other fields they don't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking back about back in the 60s, 70s, when we had these communes set up.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them failed. The ones that were the most successful were the church-related, you know, religion-related communes, because people did have a common trust in God and a trust in each other. But the ones that are just based upon smoking pot or something, they quickly collapsed, because they could, people wouldn't want to work. They wanted to enjoy themselves, and then it didn't.
So some types of relationship building is more...
Well,
if
you have a common set of
values. Yeah, the common set of values is key.
And this common set of values for these secular communes were just apparently not much there except to have fun.
Yeah.
And it didn't last long.
Okay. Interesting. Anybody else?
I don't know how it relates exactly to trust. I mean, I think there is a fair amount of trust in organized religious communities. And I think that with respect to some of the regulation of public policy and so forth, they're probably an informal agency, but in many places there is quite a bit of consciousness raising going on through the churches towards some of these issues.
Yeah.
And it's probably as powerful in the churches as it is in the educational. I mean, I think the fundamental institution that should be moving in this direction is the educational system.
Okay, first.
That should be the, but the church, both of those, however, are to some extent drowned out by public media.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I think there's a great deal of issue. I mean, the public journalism is not as on board to moving these things as probably.
Do you think people are affected by that, or
I think they're greatly affected by
it.
I mean, everybody who listens to Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck does not believe there's any kind of ecological problem.
Yeah.
And then there are the corporate entities that actually own the broadcast networks. Take the economic view that it'll harm that our corporate interests to move in some of these directions. So there isn't much out there. The church is a small voice. Education is probably a larger voice, but there's huge voices out there.
Yeah, that are kind of against it or counter.
And it can be mixed. I mean, Walmart will advertise it a green.
Yeah.
Kind of game.
Yeah. I had met a man who was working with Patagonia and Walmart and all these different, bringing them all together and talking about how can they rate their products based on their environmental consciousness, some sort of scale. And I was interested to hear that Walmart was in on that. But then you think, are they trying to get the consumer? They don't really care.
Right,
it's just
right.
Greenwash. And, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, off topic from what I was going to say, but I mean, did Walmart go into the organics because they really felt called to it,
right,
or because they knew that people in the market were calling for that, which, I mean, gets into market stuff, so supply and demand and stuff. But on the church question that you asked, I think that the church as a formal institution is very similar to a lot of other institutions, formal or informal, in that it's a lot easier to break trust than it is to build it.
Mm.
That the church can offer a formal institution in which there is trust built, and if you have had, say, a good relationship with a congregation of a particular denomination in one place, when you move, you are more likely to have more trust already walking into a congregation of the same denomination or such as that,
that there can be that sort of movable trust and things of similarities. And there's a sense in which I think we are moving a lot. At the same point in time, I think that it's also very easy for that trust to be broken. And if it's broken once, it's very hard to ever build
to
that back
that
up again, which I think is a lot of the reasons that we have a lot of regulations and checks and balances, especially on our pastors and our people who are ordained and consecrated.
And that's kind of external authority being exerted on, or is that?
But in the same way, I mean, it is external authority, but it is also something that every person who goes into candidacy, you know, agrees to and signs on to. You know what you're getting yourself into when you walk into it. Doesn't mean that people may not try and change it from within, but.
So now, you mentioned something about moving around a lot, and how many people have moved around in the last 10 years, have moved places? Okay, yeah, I've heard this said in the United States that there's a lot of this impermanency, that we don't stay in one place long enough to develop these relationships, and that that this is a real problem
I think several people have brought this up, the issue of education. Which I've been radically sure just about. Human behavior begins the most significant years to influence human behavior outside of the genetics that we bring in are the earliest years. And so at one point in my years, I was working at developing looking at cooperative versus competitive behaviors in young children. And interestingly, they used game, there was a lot of zero-sum games and that sort of thing. Those were the kind of things that measured that variable. And I remember one in particular was a long, narrow table in which there were two rows, a row of seats on one side and a row of seats on the other. And in the middle of the table, there was a bowl of food or ice, I don't remember what it was. But the issue was that the spoons that the children were given were so long that you could not reach into to get. The only way that there could be food is that you would dip your spoon in and give it to the person across.
Yeah.
And vice versa. And it was very interesting to even think about the fact that there were some children that couldn't do that.
Yeah. So some people didn't. Some
no, and,
didn't,
and so
but
the
some
idea
did,
of looking at what is there.
Yeah.
And I in some of the early development work that there are teachers who are very much aware that not only are we good at teaching them how to read by the time they're five or whatever, but that the main job of groups of young children together, the main job of nurturing them, one of the main jobs, is to model and encourage and reinforce cooperative behaviors.
Yeah.
Now, I often think about that and I wonder how deeply are we committed to that, how much efforts are given, how much parent support is given in those things. And I realize there is rivalry, and I don't mean to say that that's but I do think about that one particular measurement device that was just overwhelming to me.
Yeah.
You would go hungry.
Right.
Rather than feed your friend.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a neat experiment.
It's actually the, it's the, in a Eastern depiction of folklore, depiction of heaven and hell, it's the same thing of goes to hell and there's all of these people sitting around a bowl of rice and they have 3 foot
same idea.
Yeah, 3 foot chopsticks and no one can eat and goes to heaven or whatever the opposite is and it's the exact same situation but they're feeding one another.
That is something that stayed with me.
Yes.
It made me think of something else, so I'll say it if I have time, but
on a pragmatic level, and it's something that I've been thinking about, and I must have, other than PTA work, most of my work is in active transportation, so in walking and cycling advocacy in recent years. And but it's something that I've come to again and again, actually when I've been at pedestrian planning meetings. But I think there is a pragmatic function of the church, because the church provides a weekly meeting place that gathers a lot of people together in their immediate neighborhood, often, so in a specific geographic location, and it gathers a very, very broad band of people, of old and young.
And you're face-to-face, you're actually, you're
and
not...
face-to-face. And that issue of...
There's not an intermediary.
And that issue of bringing... I mean, everybody, you know, we have to have all the stakeholders at the table, but it's like, we have to have everybody at the table, because we don't always recognize who the stakeholders are. And it's not enough to have representation. And I really, the longer I have seen, actually, in pedestrian planning, more than in cycle planning, cycling planning for cycling infrastructure, the more I think it's true. It's like, hi, you know, you have somebody there who's there to represent the disabled community, and they're blind. And the issues, pedestrian issues for blind people are completely different than pedestrian issues for people in wheelchairs, or pedestrian issues for people who are old and have joint problems, or young and have joint problems. And it's really, there's a way in which I think there's a pregnant, and at one of the last community planning, I was like, you know, have you guys gone to the churches? Have you just, it's not, this is not something political, it's not something, what you're trying to gather information about is what would enable your community to walk here. And I'm like, that's...
I think it's interesting you use that metaphor, bringing people to the table. Does that, do you think,
yeah.
I mean, I
of course.
Of course with communion, does that
yeah,
strictly come from, yeah, yeah.
You know, and that idea of meeting socially.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, I think sometimes we unwittingly, in the education example, brought it to me, I think sometimes unwittingly, in the name of developing a certain skill, create competition. And it's a tutor at the same school that I have this personal experience with, and it's too long to go into, but I've tutored in two different methods, one of which creates critical argument, and more recently, I had a group who was just had really mastered the skills that they needed to master in this particular curriculum, and I got to take them into a different curriculum that was more interpretive reading based. And for the first time in that tutoring group, when I asked one of the students, I said, okay, we're gonna do this round robin, I want everybody to give me an answer, and then I want them to support it from the text. Do you think that the author is right when he says, you could marry anybody, take somebody walking down the street, take my wife. Do you think he's right? You can marry anybody. And support it from the text. And one of the kids said, I said, okay, you know, your turn. And he's like, I can't do it. And one of the students pipes up and says, well, I'll cry. Would you like us to help you? And these were really, really, really struggling students. And the fact that one of them turned in my tutorial and said, hey man, we're a team.
Yeah,
we'll help
and there's
this.
So there's the example of trust being built in that setting when people and it's that face to face.
And it wasn't it wasn't that they weren't developing the curriculum. It's a very good curriculum called Rewrite, and they were developing the critical argumentative skills. They were good skills. They needed to develop them.
Yeah,
but the methodology didn't create.
So do you,
the community.
As humans, do you think it's I won't go into that, I don't think, asking if it's natural or not natural, but how does this idea of turning trust into a model, an economist not model, smack up against your notions of trust as something that's more of a personal dear thing? Does this bother you at all, or feel a little bit uncomfortable when you think about it in relation to?
Not at all.
Okay. It kind of affirms, it kind of takes the idea of the market and rationality and competition and almost brings it, I mean, that's the beauty of Ostrom, it almost brings it to something that's a little bit more human, that is a little bit more complicated, I think, which is, yes?
Yeah. Where would this go, though? I mean, you say a core goal of public policy should be to facilitate the development of institutions to bring out the best in humans.
Yes.
To do what?
Right. Well, in this
because you've got to go beyond that in order to create the situation, and that if you have a group of people that have trust in each other but have different value opinions, And one opinion takes precedence over the other, and the person who holds the minority opinion finally says, I can't accept that opinion.
Right.
Therefore, trust breaks down, and what you then get is people that are trying to undermine the decision process. I mean, perfect example, Seattle, and voting on the tunnel. They're in the fifth vote, because there's a group of people that will not accept the outcome of the majority.
Yeah.
Now, where does that fit here in trust? That becomes a question. It's got to be for something.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Yeah. And
the best in humans thing, to do what?
The right. First thing, when you said that, John, first thing that came into my mind is to survive. Uh-huh. Ultimately, the tunnel may not be the best example of that, but it seems to me we reach a point that we cannot select who will survive and who won't. We all need to find a way to survive. Sometimes I've had this thing, if there's a plant, a asteroid moving towards the Earth, is that what it would take us to look cooperatively at survival?
Yeah.
I mean, in a species-oriented evolutionary thing, it's my survival makes you die.
Takes away from your ability to
survive. Yeah, because right.
And that's the hardest thing is this idea that we
but
live
that
in this finite.
That happens all the time in the animal.
I like that.
The argument of like the finite argument, like the idea that like, okay, well if you take this then I have less.
Right.
I've actually heard that used very interestingly in the idea of power in the workplace, and especially with women in the workplace. Had one person who was in the church very early on as a woman pastor who said, you know, it took her a long time to figure out that that sometimes it was this worry that, you know, if another woman came in, that there was only this much of the pie that was really allowable for power to go to women. And so if another woman came in, it made that one smaller, as opposed to you know, the other people in the pie being very, very upfront and careful about saying, no, actually, this person isn't like this job. And like the whole idea of what it does to us when we feel like someone coming in takes away some of our power or some of our thing. And that I think that's something that really needs to be discussed and out there and in the middle of, I think sometimes we push those topics to the side, and then it just makes us go about them in ways that aren't necessarily very helpful.
Kind of the breakdown.
Yeah, it breaks down when we don't have conversation. It was just very interesting to me.
And it's an interesting point, because one of the things that we're talking about when you talk about ecological resources are finite resources. There's not enough.
Yeah.
And that's part of the issue. There's not enough water for everybody.
Right.
If too many people take too much.
And that's where you ask, like, to bring out the best in humans. You were asking,
yeah,
what? And I think that her point in saying this is saying that outside authority isn't always the best for regulating, that people within the local situation know best to make the choices about the resource that they're dealing with. I mean, she's dealing mainly with natural resources
so
here.
Again, if we go by to survive, who will survive? You
know, yeah.
Remember those games, I don't know, we've all went through that, where you have a lifeboat?
Yeah. You've
got so many provisions.
Yeah.
You
need to decide who gets what?
Well, you decide who's going to stay on the boat. And that puts, this is why I feel so uneasy, when if it's for survival, then are we saying we won't all be able to survive because we have finite resources, so we can't all survive? Which ones are not going to be the survivors? Who's going to have to get off the lifeboat?
Yeah. It's uncomfortable to think about and talk about. Yeah. And with that idea of the community or the, you know,
unless
yeah.
early on somewhere in the lower ages of our, maybe earliest stages of the development of our human species, somewhere we get the sense that there isn't a question of which ones, but how will we find ways so that all of us can survive. I think that's what's so touching about, oh, well, let us help you find a place, or let's give you something to help you survive.
Yeah, and that's also what I think is so, when I think about Christianity being radical in a way, or this church service, or the messages, or the Bible, or, you know, the word being radical in a way, is it's giving us that creative outlet for rethinking things like finite resources. I always think Bible school, one of the themes was enough for all at one point, and holding that up is something that we should work toward is, yeah.
I suppose there's not enough for all. What do you do then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the saints was that tore his robe in half and gave it to a poor person that was cold in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. Well, who was that?
The thing I just looked out on the Feast of Stephen in the park.
No.
Oh.
This is one of the, like, Augustine or somebody like that. Yeah. One of the old
Saint
saints.
Francis?
Yeah.
Maybe Saint Francis. We saw this beggar, and he earned his sainthood. Was one of the big things, by taking his robe and carrying it in half and giving half to the poor person. Mm-hmm. And then somebody came along and said, that was wonderful. And somebody came along and said, but suppose there were 50 poor people, what would you do? Would you all freeze to death? This is wintertime. Would you all freeze to death? Or could he keep his robe? Or just give it to one of the, say, 15 or 20 beggars? What would you do? So, yeah, that's it. It's fine to be cooperative when there's not really much at risk.
Right.
When there's a lot at risk, or ultimately your life or your family's life, something like that, you're going to do all you can to survive.
And that's when we kind of, as a community, reach that idea of the threshold. Like, are we moving past the point of no return? How do we deal with it? And I think to myself of that reality, and yet, in the face of that reality, not being able to give up hope and despair, I guess, to me.
That's why I keep bringing up about population growth. You know? I mean,
yeah, and Hardin.
We got a finite earth and a finite resources, and the more people are on this thing, the share of it, the more difficult it's going to be.
There's a really good book that was written, and I think it was put out in 1995, called Population, Consumption, and the Environment. Harold Howard is the editor, and he draws on, I just got finished with a section written by a rabbi, I believe, but on all the different religions and how they view population and consumption and kind of how the words of the different church bodies or faiths deal with this concept. And it's not an easy, there's no easy solution. And it is a problem. It's a driver of environmental policy, and it's a population's difficult topic. Yeah.
I've been going to some of these Palestinian talks, and probably the biggest problem over there is too many people after scarce resources. Never know where they're, you know, like the Jordan River is totally wiped out. It's all diverted for irrigation and drinking like that. There's a big aquifer under the West Bank, and that's why I'm wondering how soon Israel is going to give up the West Bank, because that's a source of water they got.
What would you say to that? Do you?
Being there, I don't think there's too many people, but I think that there are too many claims for the same land. There is still plenty of space in Israel proper for a lot more building and a lot more population growth, but it is oftentimes based on religious reasons that settlers choose to settle in the West Bank. I think it's just something that strikes me every time I drive to Tel Aviv or every time I drive up north, just the vast open green fertile spaces in Israel that makes me reminds me that, oh right, it's not necessarily resource based, it's more ideologically based.
I've seen several times, just recently I saw it again, saying some letter to the editor in paper saying that, oh, we don't overpopulate this world, we can take everybody and give them a city sized lot in the state of Texas, the whole world, 6 billion of them. Mm-hmm. Well, it's idiocy. I mean, what are they going to do for a living? What are they going to get for food? What are they going to get their
wood,
the lumber? I mean, the footprint that you generate is much, much bigger than your house lot, space you live lot.
Yeah. We don't have climate problems either.
Yeah, that and I mean, there's we should have a whole day just for population, I think, because I hear it come up a lot, and
it's an issue, the trajectory is up. You know, I see no signs of effort to try to make this thing level off, and eventually, as people become more prosperous, and most people want to have more things, I mean, they can have fewer things or a lot of more things. More resources are going to be consumed. Now, I think it was mentioned before here somewhere that, we're 5% of the world's population in America, but we use 25% of the world's resources. Mm-hmm. And if everybody would consume like we do, we'd be around six times, I think I figured out, of the impact on the environment that we have today, which is not good.
And I think that is an important place to which the church can speak to, and to which scripture speaks to. I guess 1 Corinthians is something that comes into my mind, which as a whole, the context of 1 Corinthians is all about community and for the sake of the other. I think that is very much a place in which we are called as the church to speak to. And theological backings of created for relationship, or righteousness, a definition of righteousness being doing and being what you were created to be, so that an apple tree would not be righteous if it was growing mangoes, no matter how much we might wish that we have mangoes.
What's the Hebrew word? Is it sadik for that?
Oh,
do you know what I'm talking about?
Zedekah.
But I think that is a place in which we as the church are called to speak, and sometimes thinking about the community and the communal as opposed to the individual first, does call us to talk about different difficult things and difficult decisions as to what decisions do we think about community that may change how we lead our individual lives, and especially thinking about the global church community.
I also think sometimes that's the other, on a pragmatic level, how good it feels to do the right thing. Like, you really do. It's not like when you are in right relationship with someone and you've done the right thing, it feels great. It feels like who you're supposed to be. And I think that pragmatically, the church offers a lot of opportunities for that on a daily level. Our church has, in some ways, a lot of diversity and in other ways not, but every Sunday, I touch the hand of someone who is old, I touch the hand of someone who has cerebral palsy, I touch the hand of someone who's really radically different from me, that I don't touch every day. And it feels scary when you don't do it. It's like that person who, you're like, oh, well, they talk with a talking board. How am I going to talk to them? Because it feels scary, because you don't know. You're afraid you'll do the wrong thing. And then it feels so good when you do it. And I think the church offers a lot of opportunity for that.
And that's actually, so I'm very glad today, because this is, and I think, just close with this, and if you'd like to continue the discussion. One last comment. Yeah.
I don't know if anybody else heard it this way, but I thought Michael Pollitt briefly said in one of his first Bible classes that the students in his philosophy classes, by and large, don't hold hope for the future.
Yeah.
And if that's true, we have little hope of bringing out the best in them. And we really need to trust these people and care about them and listen to them. What are their concerns? And I think their concerns are the environment, and very likely it goes back to population going up. As you said, it isn't even leveling off, it's going up. These are the future, and if they're despairing already, that is serious business.
It's the despair. And actually, that's why I'm glad
to have brought this idea of this economic model and this idea of the individual making rational choice to the church, and to just think about kind of how those butt up against each other. And so let's just one more last comment and then we'll close.
Let's make a comment that one of the goals of mankind is to, in an economic viewpoint, is to increase productivity. And what that means is you get more output with fewer people. That's the goal. I mean, like, you can compare the poor farmer in Mexico with an old mule plowing the ground and growing some corn. Some of these Midwesterns have these eight-wheeled John Deere tractors that pulls a plow that's 42 feet wide. I mean, how could they compete? You know, there's no way. They are so much more productive. And but that's the point.
This is all. I feel like I need like two more sessions to get.
I'm an engineer, and I know that. That's what we're trying to do as engineers. We're trying to make things more, give people more things.
Efficient.
Every individual will be more productive.
And there's just a divide.
There's also a finding.
So only fewer people are doing mundane jobs. That's why food's cheap in this country. It used to be like 95% of the people in the country were farmers. Now it's about 5%.
I think we need like 5 more sessions to discuss. I'm making my list of other topics. So thank you so much for coming today, and I hope you have a good day.